Welcome back. We are going to have two lectures today, the lecture on Monday and then the lecture we're supposed to get today. Monday's class was going to be on a review of what you learned in, 238? What's the architect, whatever the architecture class is. So we are going to go over hardware systems and architecture. Now, I have numbers on here. But the first thing is, this started 4, which I know is not correct, because 4 is in processes. So I actually don't know where these lecture notes came from. And also, they're out of order, but I did that because I didn't like the order that the book used. I guess if you actually wanted to read something, you should probably read Chapter 1 in Silberschatz, Glavin, and Gagné, but Chapter 1 isn't very interesting and actually doesn't cover a lot of the stuff that I wanted to cover. So I got some other book, which I didn't write down, and I don't remember exactly what it was either. But this is largely a review for most of you. I hope that won't be too much of a problem. So what we'll be talking about is hardware systems and architecture, and the idea here is just to review the important parts that we are interested in as operating systems designers and implementers. There's lots of interesting things about hardware, and in fact it gets more interesting every year. But we are going to viciously abstract to the things that we are going to be dealing with as operating systems designers and implementers and sort of ignore the rest. And there's actually a lot of things that we're going to ignore that makes operating systems interesting. For example, I'm not going to say too much about caching, but caching, of course, is a really important part of designing and implementing operating systems because you have to both exploit it and treat it well, otherwise it will turn around and just send your performance down the tubes. That turns out to be actually pretty hard to do. The other thing is that this is just going to be like an overview. As we go into each section, we are going to look at the associated hardware components in greater detail. So here I'm just going to say, oh, look, CPU. CPU consists of ALUs and the control unit, and that's pretty much where we're going to leave it. Then when we come to the actual process abstractions, we will take a closer look, but still abstract look, at what we need to know about CPUs in detail. So this will be a pretty high-level lecture. Hopefully it will be mostly review. And we'll start by taking a look at the architecture, principally because I'd like to see the entire thing first before we pick it apart. So I'm going to start with the architecture. And I'd like to draw a picture. What would that picture look like? What kind of pieces do I need to have up here? Big pieces, not little pieces, big pieces. If I wanted to draw a picture up here, of course I'm going to draw boxes. What kind of labels do I want to put on those boxes? Pick a component.
CPU.
Central processing unit, another box. Okay, in particular? Okay. And we come to my first idiosyncrasy. I don't like to refer to it as memory. I prefer to think of it as storage. So I'm going to be saying storage. You can say memory if you want. And in particular, we're interested in primary storage. This is storage that, as we'll see, has some properties. Or main memory. Another box. A couple boxes more. We'll put that in the CPU. Actually, that's not true. That's too low level. But we'll call it the CPU. Yes.
Controller device.
Device controllers. Excellent. I did the spelling thing, right? The spelling, the unfortunate correspondence between spelling and handwriting. Did I do that? I didn't? Okay. My handwriting is terrible. All right, so I will try and write legibly. My spelling is also bad, and those two things interact because it's like, how do you spell strategic? It's S-T scribble. Okay, so if you can't read what I write, just say, what is that word? Let's put some more stuff off of this. So I'd like to have some things that hang off of this. What kinds of things do I want?
Keyboard
would be one, which we'll just draw like that. USB would be another device controller. Let's put that here. Something off the USB. Well, actually, we need some things off the device controller. Why don't we finish that part of the picture, and then let's put something off the USB. Okay. Well, actually, we need something else for the monitor. Right. First, we need a card, and I'm making a mistake here. So we need a controller, a graphics card, and off of that, we have the monitor. Well, actually, it's not the monitor. Let's just draw a big square thing. But let's get something off the USB. Yes.
Secondary
storage, or what's another name for secondary storage? Hard disk, right. And, you know, you could have said, the shiny ones, CDs, DVDs, stuff like that. Okay, and let's just finish this up. We have a keyboard. I feel there should be something else off the device controller. But I can't think of what it is, but we'll leave it like that. Now, we're missing one thing, and what is that? No, we'll leave that. So Yeah, you could put a sound card in, but that's actually too much detail. In fact, the graphics controller was probably too much detail. So if you haven't gotten this far, you don't have to put that in. But we are missing one other thing. I mean, look at this picture. What does it say to you? What do you have at this point in the architecture? Well, not just a paperweight. Well, power, who cares? That comes from somewhere, the wall. But, yeah, you do need a power supply. In fact, I'm reading – well, never mind. We have many paperweights, right? And what do we want? We want one big paperweight. How do we get that one big paperweight? What are we missing in this picture? Sorry? Yeah, no. That's essentially the CPU, a few other things. Maybe you put a couple of controllers on the motherboard too. What are we missing in this picture? How do we turn a bunch of independent paperweights into a single paperweight? Buses, exactly. We need a bus. What does that look like? Lines. And any particular? I mean, I'm not an artist, so you have to give me a little guidance here. How do I draw lines? You see, I didn't do this right either. Now we have a single paperweight. All right. So this, we are going to take this as our architecture. This is the playground that we're going to be spending our time in. Now. Of course, this is an extremely simple diagram, right? We left out some things. People said sound cards, and there are other things that people said that we left out. And like I indicated, we could probably leave out the graphics card. I just wanted to get the general idea down as to what we are going to deal with. This, I'm hoping this is familiar to everyone. What is this called? What is this kind of architecture called? It's called the von Neumann architecture. After John von Neumann. And this will be important because it has some characteristics that we're going to have to deal with as, certainly as hardware designers, but also we're going to have to make accommodations to those designs as operating systems implementers. There is an alternative. Well, first of all, why is it called the von Neumann architecture? I believe this is the second bullet item here, so let me just redo that again. John von Neumann, did I identify him as a Hungarian polymath? He was essentially a genius. He invented the computer, as well as all sorts of interesting parts of the atomic bomb, and he had a hand in weather forecasting, which is something of sort of immediate importance, or at least most recent importance. So he was a very smart person. I guess the question is, what's the characterization of the von Neumann architecture in this picture? We'll take a look at an alternative characterization in a second. How do you look at that? And you would strike your chin and say, von Neumann architecture. What are you looking at when you say that? What is it that makes you say that? Or what is it that suggests you should say that? Well, actually, that's kind of a tricky question. This part, I can use colors. This part right here. This is the thing that suggests to you a von Neumann architecture. The reason for that is John von Neumann's great idea, the reason that we dignify this with the idea of an architecture, apart from the fact that he sort of built this, or he had people build it at down the road at Princeton at the Institute for Advanced Studies, is the idea that you can integrate the program that you execute, we'll take a look at that later on in the lecture, with the data upon which you do the execution. Prior to this, there is a separate architecture. Anybody know offhand what it's called? I mentioned Princeton. Another architecture that you run across, particularly if you ever find yourself in the embedded systems area, is the Harvard architecture. And that looks like this. All right, you had a CPU and you have two stores, two primary stores, one of which contains the data and the other of which contains the code. All right, so you have two separate representations of your program, and these could be quite different. And von Neumann had the insight that you could unify these two things into the same storage representation and end up with an architecture like this. That was von Neumann's great insight. We're not going to be talking about this, but as I said, if you ever get into embedded systems, a lot of embedded systems have a Harvard architecture to them. All right, so that's the first big benefit that von Neumann gave us, essentially this idea of embedding or unifying the representations of code as well as data. What did that cost us? What are we paying for? This is another thing that you will struggle against as hardware designers and also have to accommodate as operating systems designers. What is the cost of this unification? You can actually see it. Is this, well, first of all, is this efficient or inefficient? Just looking at it. Why would you expect that? Your intuition is right. Why would you expect that to be the case, though? What is going on that gives you... And you can sort of see it just by looking at the picture. Why would you expect this to be... Well, actually, we should also sit here and argue about what efficiency means. But let's not do that. Let's just say, yeah. But in particular, why would you expect this to have some interpretation of efficiency, better efficiency than this? That's almost right. Yeah, you're correct, but there's actually something even more important. Bandwidth, right, but so what would you expect the bandwidth here to be? If we hold the lines as constant, what would you expect the bandwidth to be? Why? Yes, that's correct. For the Harvard architecture, right? Yeah, yeah. Why is that? Well, I mean, just look, what's the bandwidth here? Exactly, you have two lines instead of one, so you have, in a sense, twice the bandwidth. Another way to say that is you have parallel access. This architecture can access data and code at the same time, both coming over the same line, or different lines, sorry. So yeah, you have two lines, and in fact that does double the bandwidth, but more importantly, it gives you greater bandwidth, as you said. Well, what about this?
Cost versus efficiency, right?
Yeah, but what's the cost? We know we have some idea of what efficiency is. What's the cost? Oh, we don't care about that. Hardware? Cheap. Okay. Cheap. But what are other measures of cost? Right. So it's time. What does that, I mean, carry that out? What are we talking about? We're talking about accessing primary store, right? These are, I'm just going to state this as a matter of fact, these are passive devices, right? So they react, they don't act. Actually, we're going to talk about that in a minute. Let us say incorrectly that the CPU is the only active device. It's the only thing that initiates stuff. That is completely wrong, but we'll fix that later. So we don't have to worry about that. Well, we answered that question, twice the bandwidth, right? So if we have X bandwidth here, assuming we forget the sharing part, which we can't, but we will, then we have 2X here, right? So essentially, and this is not correct, but you can divide by 2. That cost, the fact that everything has to go through primary store, data and code, that's nice because that means you can have one of them, but that's also more costly because you essentially half your bandwidth. You can't read the code and the data at the same time. The fact that you're going through a single connection between primary store and the CPU is known as the von Neumann bottleneck. Okay, and this is going to be something, like I said, that the hardware architects have to struggle against, and it is really hard. This was this architecture was developed in the early 40s, 1940 to 45 or so, and hardware designers have been fighting against it for, you know, the past, I guess now, 70, 80 years, and this von Neumann architecture still wins. It's amazing how durable that architecture is. So it's a bus with a bunch of stuff hanging. Now, of course, it's not a bus, right? There are several buses, right? Because, again, this idea that we have 2x bandwidth by having two lines is really useful, right? So, in fact, what we do is we have multiple buses. First of all, we have a data bus and an address bus. So, in fact, we would draw a shadow bus here that it depends. I mean, if you have a single bus, you can multiplex it. But, again, you get roughly approximately half loss in bandwidth. So first thing is we have a data bus and an address bus. Second thing is we have separate bridges, right? These are the infamous North Bridge, South Bridge stuff, if you're familiar with that, from Intel architectures, which, of course, everybody is because that's the only thing that exists these days. So you can sort of have things on the North Bridge. I actually don't know how it goes because I've forgotten. You can have things on the North Bridge like CPU and primary store, and then you have other things on the South Bridge, and then they interconnect with one. So you can do all kinds of extremely complicated things to get that bandwidth back. But we're not going to be considering that. All right, I believe this is it. Actually, there are a few other things that we want to talk about here. But do I talk about this now or later? Questions about this? Again, my assumption, I mean, how many people have seen this in whatever it is, architecture? All right, so with this picture in mind, now we can take a look and start looking at the individual components. And principally, we are going to be interested in... Where did this come from? Principally, we're going to be interested in... What? Oh, the CPU and primary store. We will actually spend some time talking about devices, but that will be in the section on device management. And we'll start by taking a look at the CPU. For this mysterious book, I have this as section 4.2. I've decided that just sort of listening to the podcast is really hard because since you can't look at anything, you don't know what's going on. So I'm going to try and cue the things that are going on in the lecture to the particular sections in the book. But unfortunately, I don't remember the book that this comes from. It's not from Silverschatz. But if I remember it, I will let you know. All right, so we have a CPU. And as far as we're concerned, there's three parts of the CPU that we're interested in. What are those parts right offhand? And again, this is back to architecture. What three components do we have in the CPU? Well, what does the CPU do? Why do we have one? Right, you do some math stuff in there in order to do, what kind of math in particular?
Processing.
Yes, the ALU. You do arithmetic. Right, when you say mathematics, unless you're dealing with a VAX, and those people in DEC were crazed, you're... CPU does stuff like addition, subtraction, division, things like that. Real simple stuff. Right, so you have one part is the ALU, which is responsible for doing that. Arithmetic logic unit. Okay. Next part. And we're not really going to be that interested in that. Yes.
Control unit.
And the control unit, what does that do? That's true, but it's actually kind of vague, right? So could you... and also reduce the scope. Okay, but what does that mean? Yes, you're right, but what does it mean to control the basic operations? What in particular does it do? And this, again, this is a simplification, so keep that in mind. We're not going to talk about that now. We'll talk about that when we get to storage management. But yes, you're right. There's something in here called an MMU, memory management unit. But let's go back to control. What is control doing? Very important thing. You're right, it's controlling, but what does that mean?
Taking your inputs and outputs and managing them?
Yeah, too big. Sort of right. Again, what does the CPU do? I mean, the reason I'm harping on this is because this is an important point. First of all, it's a process. That's true, and in particular, why would it do that? What's the point? What's it trying to do? You mean you're right, but what's it trying to do? The control unit is responsible for implementing the fetch, decode, and execute cycle. This is how, and we'll talk about this in greater detail in a couple of minutes, this is how the computer works, right? It fetches an instruction from storage. It decodes that instruction. The control unit decodes that instruction to figure out what it is. And this is all done, if we don't assume the systems are microcoded, this is all done on hardware. And then it executes it. Okay, so the control unit is responsible for doing the fetch, execute, and, sorry, fetch, decode, and execute cycle. And, of course, for those of you that are familiar with this, modern architectures, this is an extremely complicated part of the system. It was a long time ago when it was this simple. In fact, it's probably not even this simple if you go to embedded systems these days. Right? I don't know if you could find a sort of CPU-like chip that does things this simply. But that's as good as we need. Alright? Does anybody have any questions? So you see where the I.O. stuff, the fetch is the I.O. The input into the ALU, so the fetch actually goes out over here into primary store and retrieves whatever the instruction it's looking for is. The decode part is responsible for figuring out what the instruction is, which may include, in fact, going back out to primary store to get data. Okay? And then the execute part is done entirely within the CPU and the ALU. But that also may entail writing stuff back out. For example, if it's a store instruction, you're going to write stuff back out to primary store. All right, so there's a lot of stuff racing back and forth here. And you can begin to see the inefficiencies that come up with the von Neumann bottleneck versus the Harvard architecture. We need one more thing to complete this picture. There's actually a lot of things. Somebody mentioned the MMU. But there's one other important thing that we are going to be concerned about. We are actually going to be concerned about an MMU. But for now, we don't have to worry about that. What is the third piece that we're missing in that architecture? That picture of the CPU, sorry. Which is a CPU architecture, but... Yes?
It wouldn't happen to be IR, would it?
It would be... What, sorry?
IR.
IR? What is that?
The register.
Registers, right, exactly. So we need a register set or bank or file or whatever you want to call it. And there's essentially two kinds, right? There's the general data registers, and then there's the control registers. Okay. And for the most part, I'm going to keep them, I am essentially not going to distinguish between the two. All right, this is essentially going to be our picture of the CPU. And we'll, as we go along, as we talk about other issues, for example, in particular memory management, we will complicate this picture, but we don't need to do that now. All right? Any questions about that? So the ALU, and in fact, we're not really that much interested in the ALU. It's responsible for doing the arithmetic. We're actually really not that interested in the control unit apart from this fetch, decode, execute cycle. The registers, though, are going to be important. Does anybody know why? Just offhand, I wouldn't expect you to know this, but maybe they mentioned it. Why are we so interested in registers? This is actually going to be an important notion, something that you have to keep in mind all the time, which is annoying, but bends the brakes.
It's where the data moves through.
That's true, and that, so why is that important? So?
Because it has, it's how the CPU handles the data.
Right, but again, why is, so? Why do I have to pay attention to it as someone who's interested in operating systems?
You have to order the way in which it handles it?
That's correct, but we're not going to go into it to that level of detail. So I'll just sort of back away from that, but you're right. Yes? Did you? I mean, okay. It represents state. It represents state of the, I will say computation, but as we'll see starting, I guess, next week, process, actually. So this represents some state. And it's a very important state for the reasons that you suggested, because it represents what operations are going on. But this will be an important part of dealing with processes that move in and out. Okay, I believe that's all we're going to beat on for CPUs. Is that right?
Yes.
But having introduced the idea of state, let's again look at control registers. What are some important control registers that you probably covered in the architecture class? Or, for that matter, control registers. Just, can anybody name some control registers? There's a couple of important ones, which again are going to be important for us as operating systems implementers. We'll come back to that. I'm going to say no, because that hasn't been true for a long time. It was true at one point, but for the most part, it's no longer true. So I'm going to say no for that. Plus, we don't have to worry about that. So, anybody else? Program counter? What is that? Program counter?
Counts the lines? Or
no.
Cycle
no. That can be a register in the CPU, but we're not going to talk about timing registers, they're called. We're not going to talk about those. What does a program counter do? Oh, you need to know this. Oh, you really need to know this. Well, you're going to learn it. You can learn it easy or you can learn it hard. I suspect most of you are going to learn it hard. But what is it? The address of the next instruction to fetch and execute. All right, so this is a really important program. This is a really important control register because it essentially determines the sequence of steps through primary store. Another control register that's important, status register. This contains interesting information about the computation that is being carried out by the CPU, and it contains such things as test bits, which lets you determine whether or not the result of the last operation was positive, negative, or zero. More importantly, it has information on, for example, memory, whether or not you're doing virtual memory or you're just doing physical memory. So there's memory status, I'll call it, but that's not a really good term. And most importantly for us in this lecture, it also includes execution mode. And this is the one we're interested in. We'll come back to this later when we look at how we do execution. There's lots of other things. There are I/O registers, as you mentioned, and we'll talk about programmed I/O. Programmed I/O. But like I said, that's really not. You don't really find that on most modern chips systems. So I'm not going to spend too much time on that. Oh, there is one other thing here. Tell me about the clock. What about the clock, since I'm looking at one? First of all, what is it? What is the clock? We don't actually have to spend too much time on this because we're going to sort of have an atemporal point of view, but it's interesting to think about. Because, in a sense, it represents a boundary. It's a boundary that people have come up against within the past decade or so. What is the clock, first of all? The clock essentially sets the tempo for the fetch, decode, and execute. As the name suggests, the clock is a device that ticks regularly. Okay, let's ignore scaling. So it's a device that ticks regularly, and every tick, you execute this cycle, fetch, decode, I shouldn't say execute, you run this cycle, fetch, decode, execute. And that, of course, tells you that, in fact, what you have to do is split the tick up into sub-cycles, which you do, and that's where it starts to get complicated, but we don't have to go that far. So we have a clock which essentially sets the tempo. And what are typical clock speeds these days? You go out and drop a grand or so on a chip, on a CPU. What do you? What kind of clock speeds are you buying? Assuming you're not going to do overclocking.
2 to 3.
Yeah, somewhere around 2 to 3 gigahertz. Okay. And this, in a sense, is one of the reasons why things are getting so complex now. Right. Because I notice I haven't even talked about the idea of cores, okay. Which I'm not going to do here anyway. So 2 to 3 gigahertz, and this is about the limit. You can find occasionally 4 gigahertz chips, but the essential Moore's Law thing, where you essentially double the number of transistors every 18 months, year and a half, that's no longer true. Physics has essentially achieved its victory. So the clock speeds have essentially topped out at in this range, and people have been freaking out about how they're going to get even more performance. So they've been doing other things like increasing the complexity of the CPU. But we will take a look at that, but not in great detail because it makes things so incredibly complicated. It's essentially why you can't understand programs anymore. I mean, when I was in school, like you, I used to be able to understand my programs because, you know, instructions took a couple of microseconds and that was it. So you could just sit there and count. You can't do that anymore because things are just way too complicated. As a consequence, nobody knows what's going on. Okay. Any questions about the CPU? We'll come back to this when we talk about operation later in the lecture, but for the most part, this is all we need. Any questions? All right, let's go on. The other point that we'll take a look at is primary store or main memory. This is another exquisitely complicated part of the system, which we are just going to ruthlessly abstract away from. In fact, it's really quite complicated. It's really quite amazing how primary store works. It's an extremely complicated piece of hardware. But we can just abstract all that away and represent primary store as an array of addressable units. So you have some array, and it starts at 0 and goes to n minus 1, so you have n units in your array, and this unit is, I'm going to say, the smallest divisible unit in the system. Now, that's not quite true, because, of course, you can always go down to the bits, but with respect to the array itself, it represents the smallest unit that you can access store at. Typically, it's a byte, which is typically 8 bits. It can be other things. It can be 16 bits. It can be 32 bits, but typically it's just a unit. It's just a byte. And that's primary store. That's it. That's going to be our view of that. Now, we are actually going to add structure to this when we look at how you manage this in WYSI ways, okay, But that structure is going to be something that we can overlay on top of this idea as an array. That's it, primary store. Any questions about that? And like I said, there's a lot of stuff that we're not considering here, but we don't need to, so we're not going to. Oh, there is actually one other thing, which is not true anymore, again, as a result of this complexity. And it comes from this abstraction as an array. And I don't know how much time I want to spend on this, so can anybody tell me what kind of access I get out of primary store?
Random.
Okay, and what does that mean? It is random access, that's correct. So we have random access here. But what does that mean?
It's not the data that's random. It's the
that's true. That's right.
It's the location and the address that's random.
Well, that's not true either. Right? Because, I mean, essentially you just, you know, it's like throwing things at random around the room. It's hard to find once you throw them away. Right? So what does it mean to be random? It's actually kind of a...
It doesn't matter where it is. It takes too long time.
Exactly. So give me a dignified technical explanation for that. Constant time access. Right? You can access any element in the array in the same amount of time. So it's constant time access. And again, that's not true. But for our purposes, it will be close enough. We'll also compare this to other devices which are not random access. I/O devices, and I'm just going to lump everything up into I/O devices. Give me a one-sentence characterization of I/O devices. What are they good for? Perhaps the answer is absolutely nothing. Okay, can you generalize that? Because now I'm talking about all I/O devices. You're right. Just give me a generalization of that.
Getting anything outside of those.
Exactly, devices. Exactly. I/O devices are responsible for interfacing with the system environment. Now, you can say, but what about the disk? But you get the idea. As a consequence of this property, well, you tell me, what are some consequences of this property, the fact that I/O devices represent an interface between the system and the environment? What are characteristics of the environment that show up in the nature of I/O devices? And I'm in particular driving towards a point that I want to make that's going to be important. What's one characteristic of the environment? And it's a particularly annoying characteristic of the environment. It executes independently of the system and in parallel or concurrently. So this is a concurrent environment. Okay, it's also an independent, for the most part. Now, you could argue that there are certain dependencies going back and forth, and to a certain extent, you'd be correct, but in the larger sense, they're independent. So we have an environment that is concurrent with the system and independent from the system, for the most part. What does that mean with respect to the devices, given their job? Well, if the thing that the devices deal with are independent and concurrent, what do the devices themselves have to be? Also have to be independent and concurrent. Or at least have the appearance of being so. Because if the device, if the environment at any time, for example, think of some Joe at a keyboard, if the environment at any time could press a key, then the device associated with managing that sequence of events also has to be independent and essentially executing concurrently. And this brings us back to a point that someone raised earlier about the controllers. And when I said that we consider the CPU to be the only active part of the system, the rest of the boxes are passive. We are going to generalize that slightly by pointing out that these parts of the system, the device controllers, are in fact also concurrent in the system. Now again, this doesn't have to be the case. We will take a look at systems in which that's not true. We will take a look at systems in which the CPU is the main active element. But those generally tend to be very small systems or very old systems. In modern systems, you have lots of independently executing entities in the computer system, okay, with a corresponding increase in complexity in the way that the system itself operates. Okay, so the devices need to be also at least managed in a way that are, at least give the appearance of being independent and concurrent to be able to keep up with the environment. And that's also true for these kinds of devices here. Like I said, you could whine with this definition because, well, what about the disks? What about tapes? But tapes are physical devices, disks are physical devices, and to a certain extent, they do operate deterministically, but nevertheless, they do have some measure of concurrency involved, too. And as I said, as we consider each category of devices, I.O. devices, disk devices, we will add to the details. Okay, so let's take a couple of minutes to talk about device controllers. So I've already identified those as sort of a separate nexus of execution within the architecture. And I will essentially just represent device controllers as the interface between the system architecture, the hardware architecture, and the actual devices themselves, the keyboards, the disks. All right, so it represents an interface. And on one side of the interface is the system, and on the other side is the device. Between the controller and the device, communication occurs via some protocol. Okay, for example, like SCSI or some other form of device control, USB, another example. So there's a protocol here. SCSI stands for Small Computer System Interface. It's a sequence of commands. And, of course, USB, Universal System Bus. And then on this side, well, it depends on the actual hardware involved, but usually the controller appears as a set of locations in storage, so registers. There are also, on some systems, to go back to the programmed I.O. stuff, there are also some systems in which the CPU has specific instructions that do, that essentially manipulate the controller. But those are, like I said, either small or old systems, so we're not going to consider them too much. As you might expect, this is a fairly complex part of the system, and one of the first things you want to do is bury that. Just layer it right out. But, of course, that comes at a cost, which we'll talk about later. Any other questions about this? So this, in a sense, represents the static portion of the architecture. Okay, so let's go on to how this all works. And we'll actually come back to this in the second lecture. But let's get the basics down. So let's look at system operation. And let's start with boot up. What happens at boot up? So now what we're interested in is sort of the general theory of how this works, how the system works. And essentially, the system is going to be this. It's going to be a bunch of hardware. In the next lecture, when we talk about operating system structure and architecture, we will motivate the purpose of operating systems by considering this particular question, the system operation, in greater detail. But for now, we just want to make sure we understand what that is. So what is the sequence of events, let me say, not instructions, that the system goes through when it is in operation? And we'll start from boot up. So what is boot up? What happens when the system is powered up? Remember, the system is powered up. I flip the switch to on. And now what happens? Yes, into the RAM, right, because it has to. I mean, if you're going to execute anything, it's got to be in primary store. But what is it? Okay, not quite the BIOS, but... Yes, there you go. The boot block. So we have a boot load. So in hardware somewhere, when the power goes up, and of course there's other things like you have to watch for transients and blah, blah, blah. But let's skip all that. So at some point there is some hardware that will physically access the disk, okay, and read in, let's say, the first sector of the disk into a particular location. So the boot block loader will go out and read the first sector of the disk, which is like 256 bytes, maybe half a kilobyte, and loads it at a particular place in primary store. That particular sector of the disk is known as the boot block. It reads the boot block and into primary store, and then it has to execute it. So in order to do that, it sets the PC. Sets the PC to the first byte, so when the fetch, decode, execute cycle starts, the PC will read the first instruction in that boot block, and then essentially it turns the CPU on. Okay, so that's the initial boot sequence. And then what happens? Oh, there's actually an important point here, which is right here. What's so special about this? And again, we'll have to not be really modern, because it turns out what I'm going to attempt to elicit from you is not really true. At this point, right here. So this is like the third or fourth thing in from power up. The interesting point is this will be the last time the CPU is idle. Until the system stops executing, the power goes off, the CPU will be continuously doing fetch, decode, and execute cycles. Right, so in that sense, the CPU is like a shark. Right, we all know about sharks. Sharks have to be moving constantly or else they die. Well, the same thing with the CPU, except the CPU doesn't know how to do anything else. It's just continuously fetching, decoding, and executing instructions. And it starts here. Now, that's not quite true because you can suspend CPU because we're really worried about power these days because we have things in our pocket, little spy machines in our pocket, and we want to have them run for as long as they can. So we do all kinds of tricks, including turning off the CPU or slowing it down or whatever. But, again, we're not going to go into it at that level of detail. All right. Now what happens? What's in that boot block? Remember, you've only got a quarter, half kilobyte, among other things. So essentially what the boot block does, now we're in not the boot block loader, but the boot block itself, reads in the rest of the operating system and then sends execution to that operating system. It does, you know, it sets up, for example, file systems, depending upon what you're doing. But for the most part, you only get, like I said, you only have a quarter to a half, maybe 1 kilobyte to play with, so you can't do a lot. So essentially what you do is you bring in the initial part of the operating system, and you can repeat this several times. Right? You read in the initial part of the operating system, it goes through and does some initialization, then reads in the next part of the operating system, and so forth and so on. It can get really complicated, but essentially it looks like this. And I believe at this point I will stop. So that represents our quick run through hardware systems and architecture, including a very small piece of theory of operation, but it's all that pretty much we're going to need. Any questions about this?